The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine dated Friday, July 20th, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. As always, we begin with the main story section. An economy stuck in the doldrums. What happened? The outlook for the American economy darkened this past week as the latest jobs report showed it settling into a prolonged stagnation. The economy added only 80,000 jobs in June, beneath analysts' expectations, and the unemployment rate remained at 8.2% for a second straight month. Only 225,000 jobs were created in the second quarter of 2012, compared with 697,000 jobs in the first 3 months of this year. Economists now say the unemployment rate is unlikely to dip below 8% by November, presenting a serious threat to President Obama's re-election. Obama attempted to put a positive spin on the numbers, saying he inherited the worst economy since the Great Depression, and that private sector businesses had made steady progress on his watch, adding 4.4 million jobs over the past 28 months. We've got to grow the economy even faster, and we've got to put even more people back to work, he said. Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney called the jobs report a kick in the gut for Americans. We've looked at almost now 4 years of policies that have not gotten Americans working again, he said. Romney said that if elected in November, he would create jobs by expanding domestic energy production and cutting the corporate tax rate. Now here's what the editorial said. The Obama recovery is sputtering like a limp balloon, said the New York Daily News, but the president is sticking to his out-of-touch, glass-half-full message. Blaming his predecessor and congressional Republicans is spin, and voters see right through it. It's Obama's job to lead us out of the doldrums. Our suggestion, said Bloomberg.com, a short-term stimulus package, perhaps with a temporary tax rebate, and a long-term proposal to lower the deficit and show investors that the U.S. is serious about resolving its bloated budget. Try getting that past Congress, said the New York Times. Obama last year proposed a new $447 billion stimulus package that would have created up to 1.9 million jobs through state aid, infrastructure spending, and tax breaks for new hiring. But obstructionist Republicans blocked it, having figured out that the weak economy is their best shot at victory in November. Since the GOP remains opposed to anything that would actually help the economy, there is virtually no chance for change in the months ahead. Now here's what the columnist said. The real obstruction to our economic recovery, said Larry Kudlow in NationalReview.com, is Obama himself. All the last round of stimulus spending and bailouts achieved was a recovery that ranks dead last in modern times, with feeble GDP growth of just 6.7% since the recession ended, compared with 17.6% at the same stage during the Reagan recovery. At least this won't go on much longer. With jobs numbers like these, Obama's goose may already be cooked. It's way too early to tell, said Scott Clement in WashingtonPost.com. All the polling evidence suggests that voters pay little attention to monthly jobs reports, After the abysmal May jobs report, Obama's economic job approval hardly moved at all, and neither did his numbers against Romney. A decimal point change in the unemployment rate won't sway undecided voters, said Jesse Singal in the DailyBeast.com. They'll judge the economy by what's going on around them. Are their friends and neighbors getting hired? Are they getting raises? It's by these metrics that they'll decide Obama's fate. The real political test comes after Labor Day, said Robert Reich in Salon.com. During the summer, as Americans enjoy vacations and the outdoors, they aren't focused on politics. But if the economy resumes moving in the right direction in September and October, Obama has a good chance of being reelected. If we remain mired in the doldrums, he'll be a one-term president. Ronald Reagan's reelection victory in 1984 is a good yardstick, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. A deep recession had ended in 1982, but in November 1984, unemployment still stood at 7.4%. Fortunately for Reagan, the rate was moving in the right direction by Election Day. To pull off Reagan's trick, Obama needs another downward dip in the unemployment rate, and he needs it soon. Now from the main story section, the next article is entitled, Liberals Sweep Libyan Elections. A coalition of liberal parties appear to win a landslide victory in Libya's first election since the fall of Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi, breaking the Islamist wave that swept across neighboring Egypt and Tunisia after the Arab Spring. Preliminary results show that a centrist alliance headed by former interim Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril won a majority of seats in the country's new parliament, besting Libya's branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Libya is not Tunisia or Egypt, said Jibril, a U.S.-educated academic. We want to build a country without classification and barriers. Some 1.8 million Libyans, a turnout of nearly 65%, voted in the country's first free elections in 50 years. We never imagined we would ever be doing this, said Tripoli resident Aisha Liab. It's fashionable these days to say that NATO's intervention in Libya left that Arab country no better off, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. But that's not the way Libyans, who joyously voted in this election, see it. The vote wasn't perfect. Gunmen stormed several polling stations in the east, and tribal groups in the south tried to sabotage the vote. Yet Libyans defied the threats. That's progress, and it wouldn't have been possible without the West's worthy intervention. But Libya is far from being a true democracy, said Paul Piller in nationalinterest.org. Many people simply voted along family lines, and Jibril won because he's a member of Libya's largest tribe. Unless the new government can unite the country's rival clans, Libya could again explode into violence when the post-Qaddafi good vibrations wear off. Jibril has major challenges ahead, said Shashank Joshi in the Daily Telegraph, that's in the United Kingdom. He faces tribal warfare in the south, regional grievances in the east, and an unemployment rate of 30%. These are big problems for a weak state, even one flush with oil money. Still, Libyans always knew the democratic transition would not be easy, and this week they took a huge step in the right direction. The next article from the main story section, a battle over the Bush tax cuts. President Obama launched an election year tax fight this past week, proposing to extend the Bush tax cuts for 1 year on income of less than $250,000, while allowing taxes on the wealthiest 2% of Americans to rise. The White House said the proposal, which would let the top tax rate increase from 35 to 39.6%, would raise $822 billion in new revenue over the next decade. GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney quickly dismissed the plan as economically harmful, saying that higher taxes on small businesses and job creators would only kill jobs. The president is right, said the New York Times in an editorial. Higher taxes on the wealthiest Americans are a matter of fairness and responsible policymaking. Without them, we can never move ahead toward solving the nation's budget problems. The Republicans' insistence that this plan will hurt small business is nonsense. In fact, only about 2.5% of small business owners would have to pay more. We can only hope that middle-class Americans won't allow the economy to be held hostage by the GOP's fealty to the rich. This plan makes no economic sense, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. The last thing our weak economy needs is a massive tax increase on those with the capital to invest and therefore create jobs. And it's simply false that taxes on the wealthy would merely revert to Clinton-era rates, as Obama insisted this week, said the Wall Street Journal. Does he think we've forgotten about the billions of dollars in growth-killing Obamacare taxes and surcharges on investment income? And even if higher income taxes affect only a fraction of small businesses, they would hit the most productive of them, the very ones most likely to hire workers. Obama and everyone else in Washington knows this plan won't make it through the Republican-led House, said Patricia Murphy in the DailyBeast.com. But that's beside the point. By lining up on whether or not to tax the rich, both parties get to remind voters of what is at stake in the November elections. As they dig into their positions, however, they can't be allowed to forget that unless Congress acts, all Americans will see their taxes increase when the Bush tax cuts expire on January 1. Right now, no one in Washington is talking about that. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in The Week magazine. Our article here is entitled, Global Warming, the Cause of This Week's Wild Weather? And that's a question, not a statement. Is it the cause of this summer's wild weather? If you want a glimpse of some of the worst of global warming, said Seth Borenstein in the Associated Press, take a look at U.S. weather in recent weeks. A record-shattering heat wave put more than half the country under a broiler, with temperatures reaching 104 degrees in Montana, 105 degrees in Indiana, 109 in Tennessee, 113 degrees in South Carolina, and 116 degrees in Arizona. Some 56% of the sun-baked country is in a prolonged drought. In Colorado, forests left dry as tinder burst into flames, with wildfires blackening more than 100,000 acres. From Kansas to Iowa, cornfields were left stunted and wilted in the punishing heat. In Washington, D.C., a vicious thunderstorm knocked out power and left the city roasting without air conditioning for days in 105-degree temperatures. Flights from Reagan National Airport were halted when the tarmac melted in the sun, trapping planes' tires. For the entire country, the National Climatic Data Center announced the first 6 months of 2012 were the hottest ever recorded, an amazing 4.5 degrees above the 20th century average. Still don't believe in climate change, asked Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Then you're either in deep denial or delirious from the heat. The scientific evidence is undeniable, said atmospheric scientist Don Wubles in NationalJournal.com. We can't blame any single heat wave, drought, or storm, or climate change, but there are now 35% more heat-trapping greenhouse gases in the atmosphere than a century ago. And as the world's climate warms, we're more likely to get more extreme weather, hotter and more frequent heat waves, more prolonged droughts, more powerful storms. There can no longer be any doubt human-induced climate change is affecting our weather. The predictions of climate scientists are now coming true, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. Hot days are hotter and winters are milder. A half century ago, we experienced an equal balance every year of record-setting low temperatures with record-setting high temperatures. In the last decade, record highs outpaced the lows by 2 to 1. This year, it's 10 to 1. Here we go again, said James Taranto in WSJ.com. Nothing the global warming alarmists like better than a spell of hot weather. But this cherry-picking of data proves nothing. When it's hot in July, it's global warming. When it's cold in January, the alarmists shout, climate isn't the same thing as weather, you science-hating idiot. Much of the extreme weather of the past few months is likely to be nothing more than natural variability, said Marlo Lewis in NationalJournal.com. Yes, it's hotter than usual this July, but only in the northern hemisphere. It's colder than usual in the southern hemisphere. The climate may be warming slightly, but a hot spell in one place proves nothing. Still for a hoax, global warming has excellent production values, said Bill McKibben in TheDailyBeast.com. You gotta love how the special effects team has transformed the Midwest into a dust bowl, sent violent storms to flatten Florida and Washington, and made Colorado look like Hades. First, they cranked up the heat, setting a new state record at 115 degrees, and then came the fire stunts. But as climate change deniers will tell you, all this is just nature trying to compete with James Cameron. So sit back and grab a big tub of popcorn in this epic disaster flick. We're not even close to the finale. Now, from the main story section of the Week magazine, we will turn to the popular section, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for boomer nostalgia after Rolling Stone magazine came out with a list of the 500 greatest albums of all time, with 60% of its picks recorded in the 1960s and 70s. Just 8% were recorded since 2000, and only a handful of jazz, country, and hip-hop albums made the list. It was a good week for flying pigs after the federal government proposed new guidelines that would allow disabled people to board airplanes with unusual service animals to provide comfort, including pigs, miniature horses, and monkeys. Other passengers may not object. And it was a good week for a penny saved after Domus Daigle of Milford, Massachusetts, made his final mortgage payment on his home with 62,000 pennies. He collected the 400 pounds of change over 35 years. It was a bad week for Batman after physics students at the University of Leicester determined that if the superhero used his 15-foot-wide cape to glide down from a 40-story building, as depicted in comics and movies, he'd hit the ground at 50 miles per hour and go splat. It was a bad week for claustrophobes after New York City announced a contest for designing the best micro-unit apartments for young singles, a single room measuring just 300 square feet. About 46% of Manhattan households consist of just one person. And it was a bad week for wooing female voters after a German mayor ordered parking spaces to be labeled with male and female symbols, with tighter, more challenging spaces designated for men. Men are, as a rule, a little better at such challenges, said Mayor Gallus Strobel. Now we'll turn to the People's section in this week's edition of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, Friedkin's Forceful Direction. William Friedkin can be a tough man to work for, said Jeff Dawson in the Sunday Times in the UK. The director of The Exorcist and The French Connection once admitted that were he not a director, he'd have been a serial killer. It's a bit of an exaggeration, says the 76-year-old, but from time to time I've had the impulse to kill. While filming The Exorcist, he allegedly fired a gun behind the head of lead actor Jason Miller to enliven his performance. On the set, he delivered a hard slap to the face of Father William O'Malley, a genuine priest, not a trained actor, to capture the correct look of shock he wanted. It was a trick the old-timers used to use all the time, he says. O'Malley thanked me for it and blessed me for it. Nowadays, Friedkin would like to slap around some of the producers and studio bosses running Hollywood. When I started, films were largely influenced by literature. Films today are largely based on comic books and video games. You don't have to think anymore. But he reserves his biggest tirade for the onslaught of 3D and the special effects showmanship of directors like James Cameron. You want to see the pyramids in 3D, he growls? Go to hell over to Egypt. An old-fashioned social networker, Harvey Bennett, could be the world's leading bottle messenger, said Corey Kilgannon in the New York Times. The 61-year-old tackle shop owner has spent his entire life in a Magansett on the eastern tip of New York's Long Island. And every few months since childhood, he has put a note in a bottle and thrown it into the ocean. It's a pretty primitive way of communicating, but it works, he says. Of the hundreds of plastic and glass bottles he's tossed into the waves over the past half century, roughly 50 have been found, some as far as the Caribbean and England. It's a tremendous thrill to get a phone call from some guy in Bermuda saying, I got your bottle. Then you talk to him and find you have things in common, and you strike up a friendship. Some folks are less enchanted, like the woman in nearby Montauk who phoned Bennett just to scold him. She said, you know, that bottle could have broken and my kids could have stepped on it. But the occasional negative comment won't stop Bennett from dropping bottles into the Atlantic. For me, it's a wonderful distraction, he says. I've had adversity my whole life, and this takes me away from it. I become that kid of 6 or 7 who decided to throw a bottle into the ocean. And our next article is entitled Garfield's Sensitive Soul. Andrew Garfield is a very unlikely superhero, said Kevin Mayer in GQ in the United Kingdom. As a sensitive skinny kid growing up in London, the star of The Amazing Spider-Man was a magnet for bullies. The teasing and beating started in elementary school, says the 28-year-old actor, and continued until I was 17 or 18 in the drama school. And there'd be 3 or 4 of them, and they'd take my wallet. I'd come home feeling so disempowered and angry. Garfield enrolled in drama school because acting was the only thing for which he had a talent, or so his teacher said. In a family of high achievers, he often wondered, am I going to be the waster? But in 2008, Garfield won a BAFTA, the British film industry's highest accolade, for his portrayal of a child killer in the movie Boy A. He found the attention he received utterly unnerving. The whole award ceremony was so shocking and scary, he says. By the time I got home, I started to have a panic attack. It was the result of pure adrenaline fall off and the realization that although the success of the night had felt really nice, it was never going to satisfy me. Now from the Week magazine for this week of July 20th, 2012, we'll turn to the briefing section. And this particular article is entitled, The Road Ahead for Healthcare. Now that President Obama's healthcare law has survived review by the U.S. Supreme Court, what will it actually do? What is the purpose of the law? The Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, was cobbled together to address two huge problems with our existing healthcare system. The first is that nearly 50 million Americans have no health insurance and thus get no care until they are very sick or injured and show up at hospital emergency rooms, forcing others to assume the cost of that care. The second problem is that overall health care costs are on an unsustainable trajectory, driven by expensive new medical technologies and drugs, and by a fee-for-service system that rewards doctors and hospitals for providing more tests and more treatment, rather than for making people well. Healthcare spending now consumes 18% of our economy. Over the last decade alone, Medicare costs and private insurance premiums have doubled. The status quo is unacceptable, said Representative Tom Price, a Republican from Georgia, who is also a doctor. Everybody agrees on that. How will the uninsured get coverage? Every state will be required to set up marketplaces known as exchanges that offer a menu of private health insurance plans. People who do not get insurance through their employers can choose the insurance plan from the exchanges that best fits their needs and budget. Federal subsidies will be available to help offset the costs for lower and middle income families. A family of four making between $23,000 and $92,000, for example, will be eligible for a sliding scale of tax credits for plans purchased through the exchanges. People who were prevented from obtaining insurance because of pre-existing conditions will no longer be denied coverage and will be eligible for rates comparable to those for healthy people. For about 17 million people whose incomes are so slow that they cannot afford insurance at all, the law will expand Medicaid coverage at an estimated cost to the federal government of $930 billion between 2014 and 2022. The Supreme Court ruled that the government could not force states to go along with Medicaid expansion, and more than a dozen Republican governors in red states have indicated that they will not participate, meaning that efforts to broaden coverage in those states may fail. Will the law cut costs? That remains to be seen. The cost control mechanisms built into the law are experimental and are based on the premise that about 30% of healthcare spending is wasteful. To slow the rising costs of Medicare, the law will empower a panel of medical experts to recommend cuts in reimbursements to doctors and hospitals. A separate panel will conduct statistical studies of outcomes, whether specific kinds of care actually work, and use its conclusions to pressure doctors and hospitals to provide more cost-effective care. Some hospitals will be offered incentives to bundle costs based on a patient's comprehensive treatment, rather than charging fees for every service provided. Does Obamacare raise taxes? Yes, although less than 10% of Americans will be directly affected. The new taxes mainly affect free riders on the system who refuse to get health insurance and taxpayers making more than $200,000 a year. Beginning in 2014, uninsured people who don't qualify for Medicaid will have to get insurance or pay the tax penalty. The tax will begin in 2014 at $95, or 1% of a person's taxable income, whichever is greater, and will rise to $695, or 2.5% of income, by 2016. People making more than $200,000 a year, meanwhile, will pay a 0.9% increase in Medicare payroll taxes and a new 3.8% tax on investment income. And beginning in 2018, there will be a 40% tax on so-called Cadillac health plans with lavish benefits in an effort to discourage employers from offering those plans. Relative to the overall size of the economy, the health care law's tax increases, totaling about $600 billion over 10 years, are about the same size as Bill Clinton's 1993 tax increase and much smaller than Ronald Reagan's 1982 tax hike. Will the law increase the deficit? The Congressional Budget Office says no. It estimated last year that the law's provisions would actually reduce the deficit by $210 billion over 10 years. These savings will come from controlling Medicare costs, billions of dollars in new fees on pharmaceutical companies, insurance providers, and medical device manufacturers, and tax revenue from uninsured people and Cadillac plans. But Republicans accuse the White House of using accounting tricks and insist the law will add at least $340 billion to the deficit over the next decade. In the end, Obamacare's impact will not become clear until it is fully implemented in 2018, unless Republicans make good on their promise and repeal the law in January of 2013. And the footnote to this briefing column, defying the mandate. When is a mandate not truly a mandate? Well, the health care law does not truly compel Americans to have health insurance. It simply levies a tax on those who refuse to get it with no other means of enforcement. As a result, millions of people may decide it's cheaper to pay that tax penalty than to buy a policy. Even with subsidies from the government, for example, it will likely be cheaper for a family of four living on $45,000 a year to pay the penalty than to get the most basic and cheapest plan offered on the exchanges. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that 4 million people will opt to pay the tax instead of buying health insurance by 2016. Even if people don't pay the tax, all the IRS can do is deduct what they owe from future tax refunds. If they qualify for one, Lori Temenstein, a self-employed piano teacher in Texas who now brings her kids to the emergency room when they're sick, says she'd rather pay a $250 penalty than about $1,800 for an insurance policy. I could much more easily afford a dadgum penalty than to be saddled month after month after month with this kind of premium, she said. You're listening to our reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. as deemed by the Week magazine. The first one is Romney's Troubling Tax Shelters, and it's written by Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. If Republicans wanted the votes of the struggling middle class, said Eugene Robinson, they shouldn't have chosen Mitt Romney as their presidential nominee. Not only does Romney have multiple houses, cars, and boats, and a $250 million fortune he built by swallowing companies and spitting them out, this proud plutocrat has used every possible conceivable trick to dodge taxes. The single tax return Romney has released is full of Byzantine and opaque tax shelters, including offshore investments in a shell company in Bermuda, a Swiss bank account, and a Cayman Islands account. Somehow, Romney also managed to squirrel away as much as $102 million in a tax-protected IRA, using what tax experts say are legally questionable accounting tricks. Romney argues that he pays what the law requires and not a penny more, which in his case is just under 15%. But as most Americans struggle to pay their bills, they can't evade taxes by hiding money in the Caymans or Bermuda. Romney is living proof of the Democratic campaign message: there are two sets of rules, one for the rich and powerful and one for everybody else. The next column is entitled America's Happiest Partisans by Arthur Brooks in the New York Times. Who is happier about life, liberals or conservatives? Asked Arthur Brooks. It would seem to be a simple question, given the stereotype of conservatives as dogmatic, fear-filled pessimists clinging to their guns and Bibles. Yet scholars who've actually studied this question agree it is conservatives who possess the happiness edge. Why? For one reason, conservatives are more likely to be married and religious, and such people are happier. In fact, 52% of married religious conservatives with kids say they're happy, compared with just 14% of single, secular, liberal people without kids. Conservatives also have a sunnier view of life, believing that individuals have the power to change their circumstances. Liberals are more likely to see people as victims of circumstance and oppression, a real downer. Another downer, political ambiguity. Of Americans who describe themselves as extremely happy, 48% say they're extremely conservative, while another 35% of the happiest group call themselves extremely liberal. Partisan extremists may see the world in black and white, but they have the security of knowing what's wrong and whom to fight. And our next column is entitled How to Fight Unlimited Contributions. And this one was written by Michael Kensley in Bloomberg.com. Liberals should stop whining about Citizens United, said Michael Kensley, and do something about it. That 2010 Supreme Court decision allowing outside groups, corporations, and wealthy tycoons to spend unlimited money to influence elections may be hard to swallow, but it was correctly decided. Even liberals concede that media companies such as, say, the New York Times, CBS News, or Fox News have a constitutional right to spend whatever they'd like to exercise their right to free speech. How can it be constitutional, therefore, to limit the speech of some corporations and not others? It isn't. Predictably, Citizens United has unleashed a deluge of political contributions from corporations and the wealthy. But there's a way of evening the playing field. Make money a voting issue. That means stigmatizing any politician who tries to use an offensive amount of money to win an election. As public disgust over the such spending rises and a senator or two is defeated, it will change the relationship between dollars spent and election results, and the right to free speech will remain intact. And now we'll flip through to the back of the week magazine to the article entitled The Last Word. That's a regular feature of the week magazine that you're probably used to hearing. This one is entitled The Cup of Coffee Club. These are the unlucky ball players, says Rick Paulus, who made it to the major leagues for one single game. Ed Cermak, that's C-E-R-M-A-K, Cermak, Ed Cermak trotted in from right field, eager to take his first swing against a major league pitcher. Three quick strides later, the 19-year-old Cleveland Blues rookie was back in the dugout, most likely shaking his head at the dramatically improved pitching he had just witnessed. His next three at-bats ended the same way. A strikeout and another sad trip back to the dugout. Cermak went 0-for-4, what players today call a golden sombrero. Although they didn't have a cute phrase for something so disheartening in 1901, back then they probably just called it a day to forget. Cermak never would, though, seeing as this was the only major league game he'd ever play. Of the 17,808 players who've run up the dugout steps and onto a major league field, only 974 have had one-game careers like Cermak. In baseball parlance, these single gamers are known as the cup of coffee players. The number fluctuates slightly throughout each season as new prospects get called up to fill in for injured veterans or when a team's roster size expands in September. But getting stuck in the club for an extended period of time is an indication that something went horribly wrong, that however long a ball player worked to attain his dreams, he was allowed but a brief glimpse of the show before the curtain was yanked shut. This club is filled exclusively with people who don't want to be members. My job was to get on base, Adam Greenberg has said many times. I certainly was successful in doing that. The quote is pure reporter bait, honed to perfection after a half decade discussing and revisiting a single pitch, and he repeated it to me on the phone. On July 9, 2005, Chicago Cubs skipper Dusty Baker told Greenberg to grab a helmet and pinch hit in a game against the Florida Marlins. He'd been on the squad less than 48 hours, just called up from the Double-A team in West Tennessee. Walking up to the plate gave him a few butterflies in the stomach, but they disappeared by the time he reached the box. He set his feet, made mental a note of where the outfielders were positioned, eyed reliever Valerio de los Santos, and got ready to attack the first pitch he saw. He'd learned in the minors that the first pitch might be the best one he was going to see. A 92-mile-per-hour fastball takes 400 milliseconds to traverse the 60-foot-6-inch distance from the pitcher's mound to the home plate. That's the high end of the time it takes for a human eye to blink. Instincts take over when dealing with these kinds of speeds, skills that have been honed over years of repetition. Sensing that something was off about the ball's trajectory, the auto-response of Greenberg's body was to turn away from the incoming projectile, protecting his face at all cost. As an offering, his body was willing to sacrifice the back of his head to the speeding ball. The first thing going through your head is, this guy's dead, said De Los Santos in 2007. Greenberg suffered a severe concussion, which took him out of the game and led to years of vertigo and headaches. The following season, he hit 179 and 118, respectively, on AA and AAA farm teams, and the Cubs were forced to cut him. He never made it back to the majors. Last year, the 30-year-old Greenberg tried to get out of the Cup of Coffee Club by signing with the Bridgeport Bluefish, an independent team in Connecticut, full of former top prospects and veterans who want to climb back into the farm club system. It's a whole bunch of guys with similar stories, Greenberg told me. We're all in this league trying to get out. In late April of last year, Greenberg and De Los Santos faced each other for the first time since that fateful 2005 pitch. He threw me a hard cutter that started right in at me and fell over the plate, Greenberg said. At that point, it was like, he's good, I'm good, so let's play. Three pitches later, and another De Los Santos-Greenberg matchup led to the batter getting to first base, this time the result of a single, the greatest single of my career. For the season, Greenberg finished with a modest .259 batting average, but his on-base percentage, a stat manager's prize, was .393, best on his squad. While much of this discrepancy was due to Greenberg's ability to draw a walk, it should be noted that he also led his team by a wide margin in getting to first base after being hit by a pitch. But that was last year. He never got called back up, and this year he's no longer with Bridgeport. According to his Twitter feed, Greenberg's now spending his time hawking a dietary supplement that, according to its website, does, well, everything. But despite his new gig, Greenberg's profile still lists him right there in the first spot as a professional baseball player. The most famous Cup of Coffee player of all time, because of his appearance in W.P. Kinsella's 1982 novel Showless Joe, and its subsequent film adaptation, Field of Dreams, has to be Archibald Moonlight Graham. Graham entered a 1905 game for the New York Giants as a defensive replacement in the eighth inning. Three outs later, he trotted in from right field and picked up a bat. He was due up fourth, meaning the team would just have to muster up one base runner for him to see a major league pitch. But alas, his teammates failed him, and he was left in the on-deck circle when the umpire called the final out. He never got to take a swing. Like Graham, fellow Cup of Coffee player Ralph Gagliano never got a chance to swing a bat. But unlike Moonlight, he didn't even get a chance to wear a mitt. Digging up old bones, eh? He asked when I reached him after a short game of phone tag. Drafted by the Indians in 1964, Gagliano was a bonus baby, a top prospect whom the team signed to a major league contract in order to keep other teams from stealing him away. A number one pick these days, he said with pride. But Gagliano tore knee ligaments during his first spring training and missed most of the season. He was called up on the first day of September, and the shy 18-year-old kept a low profile for his first few weeks in the majors, never even speaking to manager Bertie Teberts. He's probably thought I was just some guy hanging around the locker room. But Teberts knew better. On September 21, 1965, the ninth inning of a 9-4 game, he called out Gagliano's name to enter the game as a pinch runner. Joe Pepitone was playing first base, Gagliano recounted. He asked me about my brother Phil, who played against him in the minors. I don't even know what I said. I was so scared. I took about a 2-foot lead after two or three pitches. The next batter grounded Gagliano into a force out at second base, leaving him with a fleeting trophy of his MLB career. I had to slide, so I ended up getting a nice strawberry, he said. I had a little wound on my butt. Made me feel good. Gagliano's next 2.5 years were spent in the military during Vietnam. But the time he was ready to return, the game had passed him by. "My number didn't get called again," he said. His voice held no regret. It was a long time ago. That's just the way it goes sometimes. 3'7" Eddie Gaedel got his first and only at-bat for the St. Louis Browns in 1951. Gaedel had been secretly signed to the team the night before, part of a publicity stunt from showman owner Bill Veeck, who called him the best darn midget who ever played big league ball. When pitcher Bob Kane couldn't find Gaedel's 1.5-inch strike zone, he trotted to first base to a standing ovation before being removed for a pinch runner. Seeing as it was his only at-bat, Gaedel is tied for the major league record for highest on-base percentage. 47 other Cup of Coffee players share the mark with him, including Jeff Bannister. "Can you hear the hail on the phone?" Bannister asked. He was in his car, 160 miles from his destination of Charlotte, North Carolina, waiting on the side of the road for a treacherous downpour to abate. Working as field coordinator for the Pittsburgh Pirates, Bannister oversees the entirety of the development process for players, including instilling a game philosophy that starts in the minors. "I'd like to say I'm managing the men as well as the boys," he says. His lone major league at-bat, a legged-out infield single, is perhaps less noteworthy than the story that surrounds it. In high school, Bannister was diagnosed with cancer in his ankle bone. Doctors considered amputation, but he refused. He endured 7 operations that allowed him to keep the foot and eventually got rid of the cancer. Then, as a catcher for his college team, he was run over during a play at the plate, resulting in 3 shattered vertebrae. Bannister overcame these setbacks and was drafted in the 25th round of the 1986 draft. After toiling in the minors for 7 seasons, accumulating over 1,600 plate appearances in the process, when he finally got the call, he couldn't believe it was actually happening. His roommate, Jeff Richardson, used to always joke whenever the phone would ring late at night. He'd say, "Hey, we just got called up," said Bannister. So he answered the phone and said, "Hey, you're getting called up." And I said, "Yeah, whatever." After making Pirates manager Terry Collins prove it was actually him and getting a legitimate reason why he was getting called, catcher Don Slott hurt himself in that night's game, Bannister finally believed his fate and took the first-class flight from Buffalo to Pittsburgh. 1 at-bat and 2 games spent on the bench later, Bannister was in the dugout when he saw pitcher Bob Walk pull a hamstring rounding third base. "I felt everyone's eyes in the dugout looking at me," he says. "They all knew the team would now need the spot on the roster for an extra pitcher." Before he knew it, Bannister was on his way back to the minors. He continued to play in the Pittsburgh farm system in winter ball and in the Dominican Republic until elbow reconstruction surgery effectively put an end to his career in 1991. As part of his rehab, he was asked to help coach the AA team, and "I just fell in love with it," he says. Since our conversation, Bannister has been promoted to bench coach for the Pirates' Major League franchise. With 25 years logged in the organization, if the Pirates play poorly enough to force a coaching change in the near future, a likely scenario since, you know, they're the Pirates and that's what they do, don't be surprised if Bannister gets to join another club that's even more exclusive than the fraternity of Cup of Coffee players, the Brotherhood of Major League Managers. When that happens, you can go ahead and list Jeff Bannister in the Book of Great Life Lessons, his entry focusing on how to turn a story that started out horribly wrong into something perfectly right. And that was excerpted from a longer piece on the all.com, AWL.com, copyright 2012 by Rick Paulus. Now from the Week magazine, an interesting article from the Health and Science section. It's entitled, "Drinking While Pregnant." pregnant women may not need to fear an occasional glass of wine after all, reports BBC.com. Researchers at Aarhus University in Denmark tracked the alcohol consumption of more than 1,600 Danish women from the start of their pregnancies until their children were born. Then they tested the children's IQs, attention spans, and self-control at age 5. Researchers found that having as many as 8 drinks per week on average had no effect on a child's well-being. Even the children of women who binged a few times while pregnant, having 5 or more drinks in one sitting, tested normally. Only women who indulged in 9 or more drinks per week gave birth to children who suffered decreased attention spans. Despite the results, researchers caution that they can't say for sure what, if any, level of alcohol intake is safe. If you're expecting, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it would continue to recommend the most conservative option, not drinking at all. Now we'll turn to the talking point section of the week. Our first article, Gay Celebrities, An Obligation to Come Out. In a country where gays and lesbians are still fighting for equality, said Andrew Sullivan in thedailybeast.com, I believe every gay person has a moral obligation to come out. It's the silence and invisibility of gays that have made discrimination and subjugation possible. True equality won't occur until the closet is finally empty. CNN anchor Anderson Cooper, who has for years said he wanted to keep his private life private, finally told the world last week what was well known to his friends, family, and colleagues. I'm gay, Cooper said. Always have been, always will be. A few days later, Frank Ocean, an up-and-coming hip-hop star, followed Cooper, telling his fans that his first love was a man, said Carl Swanson in New York Magazine. Ocean has a great deal to lose since the hip-hop community is blatantly homophobic. Still, the news from these two public figures was greeted with something of a yawn, which is an achievement in the long march toward It's Not Mattering. Celebrities should be commended for coming out, said Owen Jones in The Independent in the United Kingdom, but let's not castigate those of us who'd rather not place our private lives on public record. For many young people, coming out is fraught with peril, leading to rejection by parents and relentless homophobic bullying at school. But the prejudice ordinary people face makes it even more important that gay celebrities like Cooper leave the closet, said Daniel Mendelsohn in the New York Times. It's too bad he resisted pressure from other gays for so long on the grounds that his private life shouldn't matter. When you treat being gay like a secret, you're unconsciously buying into the idea that there is something wrong with it. Still, Cooper's public declaration of his sexual orientation is one more hand in the air, said Tim Goodman in HollywoodReporter.com. Every time a respected anchor or singer or co-worker comes out, straight people realize that gays are not threatening freaks, but fellow human beings who happen to love someone of the same sex. When I came out as a teen, said Sam Perigno, the Hartford Courant, I was sure I'd be ostracized and condemned to a life as a lonely pariah. I didn't know anyone like Cooper who is successful, happy, and in love. This is why Cooper's coming out matters. This is why everyone's coming out matters. The next article from the Talking Point section is Obamacare ruling. Why did Roberts switch sides? There's no other word for it, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts is a coward. I don't say this just because Roberts voted with the 4 liberal judges to uphold President Obama's Affordable Care Act in the last month's landmark decision. I say it because we now have learned, thanks to leaks from court insiders to CBS News, that Roberts initially voted to strike down the law but changed his mind. Why? The Chief Justice was apparently worried that if the court struck down the law's mandate that people buy health insurance, the White House and the liberal media would launch a withering assault on the court's legitimacy, accusing its conservative majority of engaging in blatant political partisanship. In his desperation to uphold the law, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, Roberts resorted to some thin and transparently twisted logic. He agreed with his four fellow conservatives that the Constitution did not permit Congress to require citizens to buy private health insurance, but Roberts then devised a trick. The law's penalty for violating the mandate, he said, was not a penalty, but a tax, allowable under Congress's taxing power. Voila! Roberts had figured out how to end up with the only 5-4 decision that wouldn't subject his court to the calumny of the Obama administration and law school deans everywhere. He deserves great credit for doing so, said Jeffrey Rosen in NewRepublic.com, after the conservative majority prevailed in a string of extremely polarizing 5-4 decisions, from Bush versus Gore to the infamous Citizens United campaign finance ruling. A recent Gallup poll found only 37% of Americans expressing strong confidence in the Supreme Court's neutrality. One more bitterly disputed 5-4 ruling, tossing out the main accomplishment of a Democratic president, might easily have eroded the institutional legitimacy of the court, past the point of repair. Instead, wisely, Roberts placed the bipartisan legitimacy of the court above his own ideological agenda. That decision has earned him cries of traitor from some conservatives, but this was an act of judicial penmanship. This was not statesmanship, but judicial arrogance and sophistry, said Peter Wehner in CommentaryMagazine.com. Whatever motivated Roberts, whether it was high-minded concern for the legitimacy of the court or the approval of the New York Times, he decided this crucial case by reasoning back to a desired outcome. His little lawyer's trick of turning a mandate into a tax fooled no one, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Democrats have always denied that the penalty was a regressive federal tax on the uninsured, knowing that such a tax would be wildly unpopular. The Chief Justice, however, apparently believes he is a philosopher king with the power to rewrite laws he prefers to uphold. A couple of short items now from our talking points section as we reach the end of our program. House Republicans tried to repeal President Obama's signature health care law for the 31st time in 18 months this past week. Every vote to repeal or dismantle the law has predictably died upon or before reaching the Democratic-controlled Senate. But House Speaker John Boehner said, "We want to show people we are resolved to get rid of this." And let's take a look at the poll watch for this week in the Week magazine. 75% of voters who plan to vote for President Obama in November say they are mainly for him instead of against his opponent. Just 37% of voters who plan to vote for Republican challenger Mitt Romney say they're mainly for him. 59% say that they are mainly opposed to Obama. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.